Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, as the fighting continues in eastern Ukraine, Russian President Putin has proposed a peace plan, and NATO is meeting to discuss the issue. What are the prospects for peace, and how is the press doing in helping us understand the events in the Ukraine? We'll talk with University of Massachusetts Professor David Kotz. Also this week, is this a golden age for investigative journalism? Anya Shiffrin has edited a new collection of Global Muckraking, and she sees some good news for journalism. She'll join us to explain. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
As the Islamic State terrorist group has expanded control over territory in Iraq and Syria, a growing number of politicians and pundits have been demanding the Obama administration take more forceful military action. The gruesome beheadings of two American journalists have only increased those calls, leading some to compare the media frenzy right now to the run-up to the Iraq War. That comparison might make some sense. Prominent pro-Iraq pundits like William Crystal keep popping up on TV, demonstrating once again that advocating for the invasions that contributed to the present chaos does not seem to affect one's standing in corporate media. Overall, the discussions about what Obama should do lean heavily toward former military and national security insiders, which inevitably produces a debate not over the wisdom of military strikes, but over how big a war the United States should be waging. The August 31st Sunday chat shows were dominated by such voices, showcasing a range of debate that basically consisted of former military officials speaking with former government officials. On Meet the Press, NBC correspondent Richard Engel was asked about the White House's reluctance to bomb Syria.
I speak to military commanders, I speak to former officials, and they are apoplectic. They think that this is a clear and present danger. They think something needs to be done.
It might make some sense to talk to some other folks as well.
On August 29th, the Washington Post editorial page condemned Russian President Vladimir Putin's action in Ukraine, which have been called an invasion by the Ukrainian government and others, with this, quote, "If any international norm can still be called uncontroversial, it is the stricture against cross-border aggression by one sovereign state against another. Certainly, any failure to enforce it in one place invites violations elsewhere," close quote. The Post can't literally mean this, as it would be a call for a halt to many U.S. military adventures around the world. And it's especially ironic coming from a newspaper that has slammed the White House for withdrawing troops from Iraq and Afghanistan. It would prefer those wars to continue. And one can't forget the paper's advocacy for the Iraq War, expressed in some two dozen editorials, unless perhaps the invasion and occupation of that country somehow does not qualify as a cross-border aggression. And other U.S. wars of the moment, waged via drones and airstrikes, receive enthusiastic support from the Post. The paper has been one of the most enthusiastic supporters of striking Syria. It's hard to understand the Post's position that Putin's alleged aggression violates international norms that are uncontroversial, but U.S. warmaking is, if anything, insufficiently aggressive, unless you understand that by international norms, the editors mean norms that apply to other nations, but not the U.S.
Well, the Washington Post's feelings about war are one thing. We know the public is clearly more reticent about U.S. military action. But the front page of USA Today tried to tell a very different story. "More want U.S. to flex muscle," read the headline over a story by Susan Page, which argued that, quote, "shifts in public opinion could make it easier for President Obama to order more muscular options in striking Islamic State terrorists in Syria and Iraq," close quote. But that shift is less than it might seem. The poll Page is talking about comes from the Pew Research Center, and it asks what might sound like a simple question. Do you think the United States does too much, too little, or the right amount to try and solve the world's problems? Now, if you answered too little, apparently that's a sign you support military strikes. It's worth noting that the majority, 63%, say the government does too much or the right amount. Are those people who want less war, the same amount of war? Who knows, since that's not the question that was being asked. But USA Today heard what it wanted to hear.
When New Jersey Governor Chris Christie traveled to Mexico, a September 2nd New York Times report called it a chance to demonstrate a level of acumen on foreign policy that has so far eluded him. Christie, who is consulting with the likes of Henry Kissinger and Condoleezza Rice, is apparently attempting to erase previous foreign policy blunders. What blunders? Christie has made accurate statements about Israel. According to Times reporter Michael Barbaro, Christie, quote, has already committed several foreign policy faux pas this year, by the unforgiving standards of Republican presidential politics, anyway, close quote. The most important of these, Barbaro reports, was calling the West Bank the occupied territories before an influential Jewish group. Barbaro reports that audible gasps ensued in a Las Vegas ballroom after that gaffe, and, quote, an apology from Mr. Christie soon followed, close quote. But as we noted when this happened, Christie was clearly correct about the West Bank, but political reporters treated it as a gaffe, something he wasn't supposed to say. The Times, with its murky reference to the unforgiving standards of GOP politics, isn't helpful. By repeating the anecdote in a piece about how little Christie knows about foreign policy, the Times reinforces the notion that an accurate observation about the world demonstrates a lack of international savvy.
And finally, as if the Ebola crisis affecting parts of Africa wasn't horrible enough on its own, along comes Newsweek magazine with its August 29th cover story, A Back Door for Ebola, Smuggled Bushmeat Could Spark a U.S. Epidemic. To make things all the more obvious or inflammatory, the photo on the cover is of a chimpanzee. The story, as you might glean from the title, is based on this notion that African immigrants' fondness for illegally imported meat could spread the deadly disease in this country. The only problem with this theory is that there's nothing at all to support it. Newsweek cites one news report linking the current outbreak to bats. But that article makes perfectly clear that scientists see the danger of transmission to humans coming from the close handling of infected animals. Newsweek raises an alarm saying that the danger of smuggled meat is being ignored by the press, which it is because it does not appear to be a real danger at all. Oddly, days after the story was published, a Newsweek editor appeared on a BBC show to defend the piece. Except that he didn't. He admitted that the risk of Ebola spreading this way is minimal. Well, okay. Two critics of the piece, Laura C. and Kim Yi Dion, wrote for the Washington Post website that the story placed Newsweek, quote, squarely in the center of a long and ugly tradition of treating Africans as savage animals and the African continent as a dirty, diseased place to be feared, close quote. Indeed.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. As the battle between the Ukrainian army and pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine continues, Russian President Vladimir Putin has proposed a 7-point ceasefire plan. At the same time, NATO is holding a summit discussing the crisis in Ukraine. Leaders at the NATO meeting have disparaged the peace plan, without much discussion, in a tone not unlike that found throughout elite Western corridors, including corporate media outlets. With us to discuss Ukraine and the possibilities of peace there is University of Massachusetts economic professor David Kotz, the author most recently of The Rise and Fall of Neoliberal Capitalism. Welcome back to Counterspin, David Kotz.
Glad to be with you, Steve.
Well, let's begin with the media coverage. What do you make of the way the U.S. media cover Ukraine? What's your impression?
From the beginning, it seems that the major mainstream media have dragged out the old Cold War playbook, taking language and context characterization from the days when the U.S. and NATO were in a standoff with the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. It's really quite remarkable.
Many observers compare tensions between the West and Russia as a new Cold War, an extension of the Cold War. You've even mentioned this a little earlier, but you also say there are some important differences.
Russia today is capitalist, and in my view, this confrontation represents an instance of intercapitalist rivalry with some similarity to the conflicts that led to World War I. When Russia became a separate state and rapidly built capitalism, a capitalist class emerged in Russia out of the former party state elite, and they got the valuable assets of that system, the oil, natural gas, etc. And they have not allowed U.S. or European capitalists to get a strong position in the most profitable sectors of the Russian economy. So it's an independent capitalist class in Russia. Whereas in Azerbaijan, formerly part of the Soviet Union, the Western oil companies have attained a very strong position, and to a lesser extent, but also significant, in Kazakhstan. They view Russia as a capitalist adversary, and I think this is what drives the U.S. determination to pull all of those new states, and particularly Ukraine, which is by far the biggest and most important, away from Russia and into the NATO orbit. It's a drive, the old capitalist drive that we see, that big capitalist states exhibit, a drive to control resources and markets in as much of the world as they can.
What is it that's being left out of the news? I mean, we basically get the impression here that Vladimir Putin is a bad actor, and that the Russian separatists are bad actors, and that Vladimir Putin is sending weapons and, if some people are to be believed, troops into eastern Ukraine to fight in this separatist war.
Well, that's what they're saying, and more. The way the crisis is presented is that there's a democratic Ukraine, and then there's Russia and Vladimir Putin, whose aim is to seize as much of Ukraine as possible. And because they're aggressors and they're evil and they simply want to grab territory, that's how they operate. And one sees in the media coverage all this imagery of tough versus weak that the New York Times and the other media will characterize any position of a Western country that, or any official in a Western country who indicates reluctance to aggressively confront Russia as being weak or not having the stomach for it. That's another term that's used, just to convey the assumption that it's obvious that the Russians only understand strength and aggressive response. Otherwise, they'll seize everything in sight. This is a major mischaracterization of what is going on in this crisis.
Yes, any sign of weakness, and the Russians will take advantage. I've seen that time and time again.
You also have U.S. politicians who might express some hesitation are characterized as weak.
Exactly.
The Republicans are, you know, sounding the old, you know, if a Republican were president, Putin would never dare do these things.
What's left out of the image of Putin, the Kremlin, Russia as expansionist and meddling in Ukraine is the U.S. actions there.
Well, that's the problem. Is if you look at the whole period over which this problem arose, it did not begin this year. It began in 1992, right after the demise of the Soviet Union, when, contrary to assurances that had been given by the U.S. government to the leadership of the former Soviet Union, as soon as the Soviet Union disintegrated, the United States began a policy of aggressively trying to gain a dominant position in all of Eastern Europe surrounding Russia and in all of the former Soviet republics except for Russia. The United States has wanted to pull those 14 former republics into the NATO orbit and into NATO if possible. That is a severe threat to any Russian government, since there have been a number of very costly invasions of Russia from the West, and they have every reason to fear NATO coming right up to their border.
Well, David Kotz, you've mentioned some of the threatening behaviors of the West, the tightening ring of NATO around Russia, etc. Are Russia, Putin, and the Kremlin faultless here?
Well, I don't think that's the issue. I don't support Putin. Putin's a repressive and right-wing ruler. He represses the left and various other groups in Russia, but he is representing the interests of big business in Russia. And the point is that he's reacting to what the U.S. has done, which represents a threat to the Russian states. So it's true, Putin has committed acts that violate international law, the annexation of Crimea. You can make a very strong case that it violates international law, although there are some ambiguities. But that's not the issue. And we see this clearly. Every time it looks like there might be a negotiated agreement between Russia and Ukraine, the United States and the NATO leadership denounce it, as they're doing right now. They don't want a negotiated settlement, which could be achieved, because they realize that a negotiated settlement would leave Ukraine having a significant economic and political relationship to Russia, and that's what they want to end. And they know they won't get that by negotiation.
So you might sum up the situation as the Western behavior has been so bad as to make even Putin look good.
It's quite remarkable. It's hard to make as unlikable a figure as Vladimir Putin appear to be a statesman, but U.S. and NATO policy have achieved that aim.
We've been speaking with David Kotz, professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts and the author of Russia's Path from Gorbachev to Putin, The Demise of the Soviet System and the New Russia. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, David Kotz.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Late last month came the news that CNN's parent company Turner Broadcasting was looking to cut something like 600 jobs. That's the kind of headline that hardly makes an impact anymore. Anyone who's watching the media is familiar with the trends. Fewer bureaus, fewer reporters, daily newspapers in major cities that are a shell of their former selves. But is that all? A new book takes a look at the state of investigative journalism from past to present and wonders if things are in better shape than we might think. Joining us now to talk about it is Anya Shiffrin. She's the director of the Media and Communications Specialization at Columbia University's School of International Affairs, and she's the editor of Global Muckraking, 100 Years of Investigative Journalism from Around the World. Anya, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's certainly bracing and maybe encouraging to hear anyone talk about the good news about the state of journalism. So how on earth did you come to the conclusion that things are looking pretty good right now for the state of investigative journalism?
When my book came out a couple weeks ago, Global Muckraking, which is a collection of investigative journalism from around the world over the last 100 years, I started getting a lot of interest from investigative journalism groups that are active today. And so for the last few months, as part of my research, I've been meeting journalists all over the world, and I've also been doing a lot of reading. And I've just been really impressed by the sort of breadth of investigative journalism that's happening right now around the world. I'm also one of the many judges of the Overseas Press Club Awards, and for the last couple of years, I've been on the panel judging the Human Rights Journalism Awards, and it's just been astonishing to me, a pleasant surprise, how many great stories I've read. I'm thinking of an incredible Associated Press series about Honduras and the violence there that ran a couple of years ago, and which really goes a long way towards explaining some of the problems we've seen recently. There's Chicago Tribune has done things on toxic chemicals and, you know, flame retardants and furniture. There's been terrific reporting from Bloomberg on labor conditions at the iPad iPhone factories in Malaysia, on fishing ships in flagged to New Zealand that have exploited workers from Indonesia and supplied to some American food companies. I mean, I can go on and on. I just got back a couple weeks ago from a conference of investigative journalism in Brazil. I was there a few months ago for another conference on investigative journalism. So there's a lot of great reporting that's being done, and we're not all seeing it because everybody now, you know, the media environment is so fragmented. People are used to maybe reading what they're used to reading. But there's so many interesting stories that are being written around the world. And I think there's probably about five reasons for this. One is that the Internet has made journalists able to connect with each other. So there's more cross-border investigative reporting happening than before. Journalists are also able to connect to sources as well in a way that maybe they couldn't before. If you were isolated in a small town somewhere or in a country, you know, maybe in Africa where there wasn't a lot of money to go out and do reporting, the Internet can really help. In many places, there's been sort of an overthrow of dictatorships, and that's led to a rise in freer media. There's also, you know, Ghana, Tunisia, all kinds of countries over the last 10, 20 years. There's been philanthropy as well. There's a lot of media philanthropy right now, and I don't know how long it's going to last. But in many, many countries around the world, there's, you know, a rich businessman who's decided to support media. That's obviously happened in the United States as well. In a way, some of the layoffs have helped investigative reporting because you've got older journalists who didn't want to go into PR, and they are now working with many of the cross-border groups that are doing investigative reporting. So I've been pleasantly surprised by how much good reporting there is right now. I don't want to say that it's going to last or that problems of journalism are solved, because obviously global pressures and the decline of advertising, that's true in many, many countries in the world, as well as the United States. But I think there's a nice moment. Sheila Cornell, who runs the investigative reporting program at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, she actually calls it a golden age right now.
You know, you refer to that Honduras investigation from the AP and the Bloomberg investigations of Apple, things that have very real impact on our lives right now and even on the stories the media are covering right now, and we don't see many people referring back to them. I guess it's part of the problem that the rest of the media industry is not paying enough attention to this great work that is out there that anyone can go read.
That's right. There's a couple things going on. I think one is that when there's a lot of information, people stop paying attention. So in a way, when you have places where the media is very controlled, one or two big stories has an impact. One example of a place where there's so much reporting that it's hard to have an effect would be, for example, Nigeria. There's a relatively free press. There's a lot of reporting on corruption, and it's harder to get people to focus. Because of editing my book, Global Muckraking, which has contributors from around the world, I got interested in this question of when does journalism have an impact and when doesn't it have an impact. And really what's clear from all the different stories that we looked at, from labor stories, from trafficking, environment, natural disasters, women's rights, that it can take really years and years and years for journalism to have an impact. And clearly, on its own, it's not going to make that much of a difference. When you look at the places where journalism actually did something, where everyone stood up and said, this is outrageous, there were often other factors at play at the same time, political turmoil, or an educated class that was ready for change, or mass popular unhappiness. So journalism on its own, really, I don't think is enough to really make the world change. But that doesn't mean journalists aren't going to keep trying.
That's an interesting connection. I want to pull you out on one piece because I think this is the thing that people always ask, is, well, how do we sustain these kinds of models? And that seems to be the key problem. Media companies are very profitable, of course, in this country, but the kind of journalism that brings in the most revenue might not be the kind of journalism that's going to expose corruption. You mentioned philanthropy. What's your sense of how these things can be sustained? Can one businessman's donation sustain an investigative journalism outfit, you know, into the future?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that investigative journalism is very expensive. and it requires a large investment in time and resources. And I think we're really lucky in this country because we still have places like the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Chicago Tribune that are still out there doing the great work. I'm less certain about the new philanthropy, how long it will last for, and whether or not the people funding journalism will continue to fund it in 10 or 20 years. And certainly some of the philanthropy is focused on specific issues rather than just investigative journalism generally. And I'd like to see more just funding for journalism and more owners who are willing to let the good stuff be subsidized by the bad stuff. But one thing that did encourage me about the book, and I don't want to sound like I'm giving up on the idea of creating sustainable and long-lasting institutions, but one thing that my research sort of cheered me up about was that very often the most important work that had the biggest impact appeared in places that in outlets or newspapers or magazines that no longer exist. Very often, somebody like E.D. Morrell, who founded the West African Mail, or Benjamin Saldana Rojas, who founded La Sanción in Iquitos to write about the terrible conditions in the rubber plantations down there. Sometimes the journalist that had the most impact was done by people who were outraged. They started writing, they started campaigning, and then later on they moved on to something else. So that sort of cheered me up, that the journalists can last even after the publications or newspapers have closed.
The future is promising because the past has been as well. We've been speaking with Anya Shiffrin. She's editor of the new book, Global Muckraking, 100 Years of Investigative Journalism from Around the World. It's out now from the New Press. Anya, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group, FAIR. If you like Counterspin, then please check out Extra, FAIR's magazine. The September issue of Extra looks at how journalists' obsession with balance skewed their coverage of Israel's attack on Gaza, and why the work of a former science reporter for the New York Times is gaining praise from white supremacists. Plus the immigration crisis, conflicts of interest at Human Rights Watch, and more. That's all in the September issue of FAIR's magazine, Extra. You can go to FAIR.org to find out how to subscribe. That's also where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the Counterspin podcast, or watch FAIR TV. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.